techniques, proven strategies. We're going to hear first from Ben Sachs. He's an assistant professor of law at Harvard Law School. He was the Joseph Goldstein Fellow at Yale Law School, where he taught emerging trends in labor law, and was awarded the Yale Law School Teaching Award. I know that because it's spectacular when we have faculty members who really spend the time on teaching, and I'm also sure it bodes well for the presentation, what we're going to learn from him. He's unique in having a strong practitioner background before going back to teach. He was assistant general counsel of the Service Employees International Union. He also worked at the New York membership-based community organization in Brooklyn and co-founded the Workplace Justice Project. So it's an enormous pleasure to have him here to speak to us about labor rights. We're then going to hear from Mia Cabernero. She's a global campaigner with avaaz.org. If you haven't been on the website yet, you should be. It was a great pleasure for me to discover the website. It's an advocacy community made up of over 4.6 million members from around the world. They address issues such as climate change, sexual violence, and extreme poverty. Once you're a member, you're going to get to participate in what issues they address. Is avaaz.org, and no, I was not paid for this advertisement. She founded the International Division, before that, of Stand the Student and Identify Coalition, and has coordinated social media in the past on the new media team at Organizing for America. And she's going to talk to us about political rights. So please join me in welcoming Mia and Ben. It's great to hear, have you here as well.
I'm going to say a few words about the state of contemporary labor rights and using the United States as an example about a couple of strategies for enforcing those rights that are proven useful. My focus is going to be on what we, in the U.S. anyway, call labor law, by which we mean the law governing the collective organization of workers and the interaction between those working organizations of one form and employers. I'm going to concentrate on the strategies for revitalizing the enforcement of labor rights, but this certainly does not exhaust the list of possibilities, and I hope we can maybe talk about some others during the question and answer. Before we start, I need to say a word about my focus on collective action. So this is based on my view, and I suppose my experience, that labor rights enforcement is largely, if not essentially, dependent on workers' ability to act collectively. So if we want rights for workers of whatever kind, we have to ensure that workers have the capacity to act together. And that, in essence, is labor law's project. So a successful labor law has to ensure that workers have a genuinely free choice on the question of collective action or on the question of unionization. That employees can choose free of coercive interference whether they want to bargain individually or collectively with their employees. These are profoundly important guarantees. Unions, of course, are not perfect institutions and their economic effects are not uniformly positive, but in many settings, unionization or other forms of work and collective action is the only genuine mechanism in which employees can participate in the shaping of their workforce. Unions have also proven across time and largely across geography to be an effective force for wage and income preservation, and they produce desirable shifts in the way that compensation is structured, giving workers health insurance and pensions, and these things are not universally available. Unionization, as I've already mentioned, also improves the chances that other workplace rights, things like safety and health care, and anti-discrimination provisions will be enforced, and a vibrant union movement seems quite important to the health of political democracy. Despite the importance of these rights, however, they're in deep trouble. So, to motivate this discussion, let me start by very briefly reviewing what ails contemporary labor law. And again, I'll use the United States as an example. I expect that some, though perhaps not all, of these features will feel familiar. And the first problem, the one which touches absolutely directly on this question of meaningfulness, is that U.S. labor law excludes completely from its coverage multiple groups of workers who constitute an increasing share of the workforce. Of greatest importance, the statute of our law denies protection to a significant portion of workers in the contingent labor force, a rapidly expanding low-wage sector that's constituted in overwhelming numbers by women working for workers. For example, despite the enormous growth of temporary employment relationships, and despite the fact that so-called temporary workers are often employed in long-term positions within a single firm, labor law forecloses nearly all communication options to temporary workers. So, like temporary employment, home care is one of the fastest growing sectors of the U.S. labor market, and yet many, perhaps nearly a third of home care workers in the U.S. are excluded from labor law protection by virtue of the statutes of domestic service. The statutory exemption of independent contractors removes millions of individuals from labor law protection, and again, among those excluded from labor law's coverage are child care workers, who also are being classified as independent. Supervisors are also out, and lastly, U.S. labor law, like many regimes, refuses to protect undocumented immigrant workers, another large and growing subset. But even for those workers who do come within the scope of labor law's coverage, the future is not very bright. The statute guarantees employees a free choice in the union question, but the law doesn't deliver on this promise. Part of the issue stems from what academics like to think of as collective action problems. So the law, for example, allows employers to ban speech about unionization on company property and to bar union organizers from someone's entirely. These restrictions are all legal, but they nonetheless lead to employees who want to unionize to bear all the costs of identifying and contacting other defendants. Beyond these sort of mild forms of impediments, labor law also fails to prevent several particularly pointed forms of managerial intervention, which create significant obstacles from the exercise of that. So, a 2009 study reports that more than half of employers facing a unionization threatened to close the firm. Somewhere in the neighborhood of a third of employers outright fired union supporters during the union organizing drive, and about one in five workers who takes an active role in union efforts is fired. This kind of conduct is illegal, but the law's remedial fails to protect employees against these forms of employer intervention. Under U.S. law, remedies for anti-union conduct have to be explicitly compensable, and remedial proceedings are sometimes proceeded with endless delays. In recent years, for example, the median length of time from employees filing a charge alleging employer misconduct in a union camp to the issuance of an order is about 700 days. That's in the United States. An employer, however, can defeat a union organizing drive by discharging union supporters and keeping them out of the workforce for a few days or weeks. So, labor law fails to fulfill its promise that workers should have a genuine choice on this question, on the question of whether they want to engage collectively or individually with their employers. The question for us today is what strategies are available to us to enforce labor rights, despite the shortcomings of the traditional regime. Despite the pathologies of traditional labor law, that is, how can we protect the collective efforts of workers to improve their working conditions? As I said, I want to use these minutes to suggest two possibilities. The first involves reliance on alternative statutory mechanisms to protect workers' collective action. In particular, the use of individual rights regimes, like anti-discrimination, to facilitate organizing. The second involves subnational governments stepping in where a federal regime has failed. So the first strategy for labor rights involved workers turning away from labor law entirely, but it's turning away from the formal legal regime designed to protect collective action, and relying instead on individual rights regimes, like anti-discrimination laws, like laws that provide for minimum wages, as the legal guardians of their efforts to organize and act collectively. In the United States, we call individual rights regimes like anti-discrimination laws employment law. So we can think of this model of labor rights enforcement as employment law and labor law. And as I'll describe it, the model involves workers relying on these individual rights regimes as both the locus of their collective action and as the legal architecture which protects that collective action from employer needs. So, what do I mean? Well, here's an example of one I've written about in some detail, and it involves sheetrock workers on a construction project in Colorado. So, according to affidavits that were later filed in this case, supervisors routinely referred to this Mexican immigrant workforce in racially derogatory terms, required Mexican employees to use different laboratory facilities than their Anglo co-workers, and prevented them from using elevators to transport heavy equipment. The workers responded to collective action. They began a union organizing campaign, holding mass meetings during lunch breaks and shift changes, and they ultimately went on strike. And the employer responded as employers do by reducing the wages of and then discharging many of the employees active in the organization. The National Labor Relations Board, that's the administrative agency charged with enforcing labor law, did essentially nothing. It merely ordered the employer to put up a sign informing employees of their right to act collectively. So much for U.S. labor law. But when the workers, supported by lawyers from the local labor union, turned to anti-discrimination law as the shield for their collective activity, they fared much better. So, on some accounts, this kind of story is quite surprising. The traditional view causes two ways of intervening in the workplace. The first is labor law, which, as I've said, ensures that the substantive workplace standards will be defined through the collective effort of workers. The other regime, employment law, is this individual rights approach, in which workplace standards are defined by statute and guaranteed to individual workers, irrespective of the extent of their collective organization. Now, the prevailing view has long been that the individual rights granted by laws like discrimination statutes and minimum wage provisions are in tension with the attempt to foster collective organization and activity. The Colorado campaign and others like it cast doubt on this and invite us to think more systematically about what the legal regime actually has to do to foster collective action. So I want to suggest very briefly that a legal regime can facilitate collective action by workers by performing three functions. The first is galvanizing a nascent organization of workers. The second is insulating the early stages of collective action from coercive interference, particularly from employers. And third, generating successive and more robust forms of collective action. So as I'll briefly describe, individual rights regimes, like anti-discrimination laws, like minimum wage legislation, can perform these galvanizing, insulating, and generative functions. So the first stage in any organizing effort involves what we can think of as galvanizing the collective. For a group of workers to act collectively, they have to develop a common understanding of a shared workplace problem and form a group identity strong enough to sustain a collective response to that problem. Lawyers and organizers and workers themselves can invoke employment law to diagnose workplace conditions as injustices suffered by the workforce as a whole. So, for example, a minimum wage law can be used to reframe the low wages paid to an immigrant workforce, not as a natural fact of life, but as a wrong perpetrated by employers on its employees. And so in this way, employment law can function as what social psychologists would call a collective action frame. Once a group of workers galvanizes to combat a workplace problem collectively, of course, they then have to contend with actions designed to interfere with their efforts. And here, employment law, at least in the United States, although I suspect elsewhere as well, promises to do a better job than traditional labor law at insulating the early stages of collective activity from employer interference. That's because the anti-retaliation provisions and anti-discrimination statutes often offer workers stronger remedies, better enforcement mechanisms, and a broader scope of coverage than traditional labor law. Now, the employment law's ability or individual rights statute's ability to galvanize these nation forms of collective organization and protect workers against coercive interference makes it, I think you can say, a viable but potentially truncated form of labor law. After all, workers who wish to organize for more than what's already in a statute, a wage above the minimum, for example, or health insurance, will find no protection in any existing employment section. That's why collective action, that's why unions are so important. It allows us to go beyond the floor. But we know that workplace organizing operates according to self-reinforcing dynamics of success and failure. So, for example, workers' involvement in mini insurrections increases their willingness to participate actively in more full-scale campaigns. That's an observation strongly supported by both qualitative literature and also game theoretic research on the dynamics of collective efforts. So, these nascent stages of workplace organizing, those that employment laws can protect, are critical. By facilitating success at these early moments, individual rights regimes can perform a generous role. They can set in motion dynamics that facilitate successive and more robust forms of collectivism. So this is the first strategy for making labor rights real. A second one involves subnational governments stepping in where federal regimes have failed. Now there's a clear political overlay to this, which is highly contingent on context, which is to say, these strategies are successful where labor movements have the political ability to move legislation at the subnational level, even if they can't do so nationally. That's the case in the United States, and I suspect it's the case elsewhere as well. So in the U.S., state and local governments have assumed the role of employer and collective bargaining partner for an expanding set of the atypical workers that I described in the opening of the show. Because these workers, temporary workers, home care workers, child care workers, are not deemed to be employees within the meaning of the federal law, states and cities are not preempted, they're not prohibited in their efforts to offer a labor law for them. In the U.S., this trend is most visible in home care and child care settings, where states have, through legislation, become the employer of record for hundreds of thousands of these atypical workers. They've given them the right to organize, and then the right to bargain collectively with either the state itself or entities that the state has established. So through legislation and executive order and various forms of official acts, Illinois, Massachusetts, Michigan, Oregon, Washington, Iowa, the list goes on, have provided a labor law for home care workers and child care workers left behind by the federal regime. The results have been remarkable. In the largest successful organizing drive since 1937, 74,000 home care workers in LA unionized pursuant to a state regime like this. Hundreds of thousands of home care workers and child care workers nationally gained union recognition through these procedures. And to give some examples, home care workers in Illinois secured wage increases of close to 150%, in California 140%, in Oregon 42%, through state interventions. So I'm out of time, but these are in very brief form two important strategies for enforcing labor rights in an era when traditional labor law has proven insufficient. I look forward to the chance to expand on these and also mention some other questions.